Welcome to Eating Consciously, a podcast hosted by Moving to Conservers, a grassroots group in Transylvania County, North Carolina. We enjoy building community through study, conversation, and local action. The goal of Eating Consciously is to learn together the impact our food choices have on others. You can learn more at movingtoconservers.com. Thanks for being here. Today's hosts are Kim Corm and John Wiseman.
My name is Naima Muhammad, and I am the organizing director with the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network. I live in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which is up at the northeastern part of the state. I'm probably about 30 minutes or so from the Virginia state line, but I'm with the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, and we are a statewide organization that work with communities living with environmental hazards such as toxic waste and other forms of pollution. And we work with communities on ways to protect themselves, to advocate for themselves. We also try to engage them in research to help answer some of the questions they may have about what's happening to them and what is it doing to them and, you know, what's the pollution levels that they're dealing with. We also try to engage them in addressing these issues from a legislative or political standpoint by trying to influence policy decisions at the state, at the local, state, and federal level. And we believe that everybody should have the right to clean air, clean water, and safe workspace, as well as being able to enjoy their quality of life and not be denied their basic human right to clean air and clean water. That right is not a privilege, but it's a right by the mere fact that they were born, everybody born is entitled to clean air and clean water.
Fantastic. How did you get started being an environmental justice advocate?
Well, I got started in, I was already politically active prior to 1999 when we had Hurricane Floyd hit eastern North Carolina, broke a 500-year floodplain, and as an organizer, I was working with this other organization called Black Workers for Justice, and myself and one other person by the name of Joan Sharp, we were the organizers, and so we began working with survivors from Hurricane Floyd, and we began by canvassing the areas where the flood did the most damage. We wanted to see what people were experiencing and where they were, what was happening with people that had been impacted by that flood. So we just began following the flood lines and talking with people to see how they were doing, if they were recovering, if they were getting the assistance that they needed, and just what was happening with people. And it was through that we began to see that there was not, certain people were not getting the assistance that they need, and that those certain people all looked alike, and that where you saw the aid going and the best conditions existed was where you found the most white people. And, you know, so then we began to realize that there was a problem in the recovery system. And so we began to work with community members that had been impacted, just talking with them, listening to them, hearing what they were experiencing when they would go try to get the aid that was supposed to be out there in the recovery process for people that were impacted by the flood. And what we were hearing was very high levels of disrespect and ill treatment of people of color as they went in those lines for aid, and that most times they did not get what they were seeking to get and what they had heard that was available, that they weren't getting it. And then as things were being distributed, the trucks that were bringing the goods out to the various areas that were impacted, when they come into black communities, they would just dump the stuff in a pile on the ground, and people had to scavenge through it like they were scavengers. And that's how they felt, that like they were scavengers, because nothing was sorted out. It was just everything in one big pile, and they had to just go through it. And that was, you know, very disrespectful and disregarding of people that's already devastated. And so they were just being even more devastated by a recovery system that we wind up summarizing it as a recovery system that was designed to shut people out, and that it was not trying to help poor people in the most impacted areas get back to their way of life prior to Hurricane Florida hitting eastern North Carolina. And so we began to organize the survivors. They were calling themselves victims. And we was like, no, you're going to stop calling yourself a victim, because when you say you're a victim, you feel helpless, like you can't do anything. You are survivors. You are still here. You made it through the flood. And so you are a survivor. And survivors fight back. They don't just sit down and let things happen. They fight back. And so you start calling yourself survivors instead of victims. And then we had T-shirts made that says Hurricane Florida Survivors. And we distributed them out to all of the survivors that we were in contact with. And they began wearing those shirts. And so then they began reconnecting to one another as groups and as communities, because they were pretty shattered and frayed and feeling very isolated, even though they were still living amongst each other in temporary housing. Where they put them, they would put everybody from the same area over in the same temporary housing section. So even though they were still living together as a community, they were so devastated till they began to, I guess you would call it, tunnel vision, so they could not see beyond their own pain. And so as organizers, we began to try to help talk people through those, through that point, and just hold community listening sessions where people could come in and talk about what was happening to them, whatever they wanted to talk about. And we would listen and try to help them understand it in a different way, or begin to talk about it in a different way, and to begin to talk to each other in order to not feel so isolated. And as we did that, you could see the change in people and their attitudes, and even in the way that they went about trying to get the assistance that they needed from the system that was in place. They became more aggressive, and you know, towards in their language, in their speaking, when they would go out to places. They weren't so passive anymore. And, we were able to do those things. And a lot of people, like in East Tarboro, which is about 15 miles east of Rocky Mount, it was mainly black community. They did not want the black people to come back to East Tarboro after the flood. So they didn't want them there in the first place. So once the flood happened, they tried to use that displacement as a way to keep people from getting back by not, you know, putting in place the things that was needed to help people get back to where they were before the flood. And the same thing with this little town called Princeville, which is Princeville, which again is right on about a mile on the other side of East Tarboro. They was the first free slaves in this area, a town where, you know, free slaves could own land. And so they were there, and it was about 400 families in the town of Princeville that got dislocated because of the flood. And the state wanted that land that we said they wanted because it could make a shortcut to the beach. And so they were trying to finagle that land from people after the flood, and we had to really work with community members and do some quick educational sessions with them about why they didn't need to let that land go and to fight to get back home. And so it was, you know, as a result of that, all the families went back to Princeville. And they wound up setting up temporary housing. Well, first they moved them to Rocky Mount from Princeville to Rocky Mount, and they put them on top of an active landfill site. A place where the landfill had been active right up to the day of the flood, where they had been dumping coal ash. And they put the temporary housing for the 400 families from Princeville. And when we heard that they had moved them to Rocky Mount, and we went to see where they had placed them, and that's when we found them back there on the area where we knew it was a landfill prior to the flood. And so we went and got some help to do some research the area and to really make sure that we knew that our facts were real and that we weren't just saying stuff that wasn't true. And so we got some help from Dr. Steve Wing from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. One of his students was getting ready to graduate and decided that he would take on the research for that landfill site as his thesis for graduation. And so he did all the research and was able to gather all the information that was needed to verify whether or not that was an active landfill and whether or not the state and the county had done the proper testing needed before you placed humans on a site like that. And especially you digging in the ground to lay pipes and stuff, so you stirring up the soil and whatever's in it is being stirred up and aerated. And so, you know, we were concerned about that. And he was able to document everything. And the state and the FEMA and the state was telling people that we were lying, that we were making that stuff up. And so when they did the research, they were able to go to the same people that we had talked with, that we had attempted to talk with, that wouldn't talk with us. They wouldn't talk with us, so that's when we went and got Steve. We was like, we need your help, because here's what's going on. We explained to him about us knowing that was a landfill there. We didn't know what kind of testing had been done. We went to the county. They wouldn't give us no information. FEMA wouldn't give us no information. And so we needed help. And we said, so we know if you get one of your students, you know, white student coming from a university with a prestigious name, that he can get what he needs to help us with this, find out what we need to know. So that's what they did. And sure enough, just like we thought, as soon as he said who he was and that he was a student from the University of North Carolina working on his thesis, they opened every door, every file cabinet, everything he wanted was made available to him. And so he was able to verify that what we were saying was the truth, and that the company that was dumping the coal ash was right across the street from the temporary housing site, still in operation. So he was able to go over there, and they sat down with him, answered all the questions about their activities, and they also gave him a tour of the plant, the whole bit, you know, because they just was so impressed that this student was there with them. But we knew it would go like that. That's why we called on them. And they understood who we were, and they knew what the issue, we knew what the problem was, why we couldn't get the information. And so they were willing to help out. And as a result, they was able to get the information. And once they compiled it and he did his thesis, we were given a copy of it. And we held a press conference with the community. And after we had a meeting with them, giving them the full report, then we called for a press conference. And we just said to them, you know, this verified what we had been saying. Now, but the state and FEMA is going to still try to make y'all look like this is made up stuff. But this has been well researched and records, you know, gotten from the very places that was doing the, that was responsible for you all being here. And, you know, so. So that's how that went. So when we held a press conference, just like we thought, FEMA and the state came flying back there in all their little state vehicles about to run each other over, trying to get back there to try to convince the community that that information was not true. And we had said to them in the meeting we had with the community, we said, okay, this is how y'all going to know we're telling the truth. Whenever you have a problem out here and you call FEMA, who do they send? They said they send their little peons. And we said, okay, but the day the big dogs come and you watch, because they're going to be trying to convince y'all that we lying. And so they're going to come. But, you know, they've never come before when you call them with a problem. So that's how you're going to know they're trying to flush the truth. And sure enough, when we had the conference, like I said, they came. It was, I don't know how many cars they sent out there. And they was flying down that dirt road. They really was about to run each other over because they were staring at so much dust they couldn't hardly, I know they couldn't hardly see the car in front of them. And so anyway, we had that. The conference and was able to put the information out. Then we had this black state director, Dr. Dennis McBride was the state health director at the time. Even he came out there and we was like, okay, so why are they sending you there? You know, you supposed to come out here and calm everybody down. So, you know, anyway, we got through it, and as a result of all of that and working with various flood survivors, the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network had formed the year before the flood in 1998. The North Carolina Environmental Justice Network was founded, and they was holding an annual summit each year. And so on after the flood, we used the summit as a way to bring 100 flood survivors together in one space where they could all hear from each other and you know, try to get some answers. We invited like state officials and elected officials in to hear from the people by having what we call a government listening panel and community speak out at the same time. So they were asked to sit and listen while the community talked about what their concerns and issues were. And, you know, that if they had some answers, they could give them, but not to be making up nothing And if they had to get back to people, they would have to do it through us because we weren't giving them anybody's individual name and number. They could get the information back to us and we would get it to the proper place. And so, that began. So by participating in the annual summit in the year of 2000, because it was the year after the flood happened, because the flood happened in September, and by the time we did all the work, that summit had passed for that year. So the next summit, we was like, it would be a good idea to bring as many survivors together as we can so they can hear from each other and get a progress report on how people were doing and what was still needed and where could they get assistance for what was still needed. And that began our relationship with the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network. And then I found out they needed an organizer, and they were looking for an organizer. So Steve Wing had encouraged me to apply, because Steve and I already knew each other. And so he had encouraged me to apply for the position, and I did, and I got it. And Steve was one of the board members, but he was also a researcher from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he was on the board. And so whenever a community came to the EJ Network for anything and nobody knew enough about the issue, we could get Steve, and him and some of his students would do the research to gather the information needed. And they would always present it back to the community. And they would always put it in language that people could easily understand. And they would come with the report and share it with the community so that they could answer any questions and make sure that people understood what they were being given, the information they were being given. And he was excellent at, his community work. He was just excellent. And we called him the people's professor because he always felt like, these big corporations, they got the money to get all the research. They can pay for all the research they want and have it doctored up the way they want it. But who's going to do the research for the people? People can't afford that. So that's why I do what I do. Because we can get the communities what they need without them having to be burdened down with astronomical fees and stuff.
Well, Nate, that was hard to hear. Those are incredible stories, but it's just so hard to hear how poorly the Black community's been treated. I'm so sorry. It's just God. Good for you guys. One of the questions people keep asking, and it's a question on my mind at this moment, is how can we help? What do you guys need? How can we be a part of this? I don't want this to happen. How can we help? What can we do?
One thing that I always think about, because a lot of people ask that question, and so I always say the first thing is to be aware of, what's going on in your state, to listen, to read the papers. Well, I don't know if I want to encourage nobody to read the papers and follow the news because they don't tell the truth either. So talk to each other and, kind of just listen for what you are hearing in the streets. The streets tell a lot. They really tell a lot. And so just kind of listen. But also, I always say to people, let's think about where stuff comes from. How do we get our food? Where does it come from? Who's paying the price? Who's bearing the brunt of this production? Like down here, down east, our biggest problem, one of our biggest problems, because we got a whole lot of them, but one of the biggest and longest battles that we've been fighting in this state has been against industrial agriculture. We have 10 million pigs in North Carolina, more pigs than people, and most of those pigs are in eastern North Carolina, sitting in predominantly African-American, Native American, and Latinx land, almost in people's backyards. And the way they handle the waste from those animals, they got this outdated system called the lagoon and spray fill system. And this lagoon and spray fill system is just where they dug a hole in the ground. I mean, literally dug a hole in the ground where they dug out all the dirt and made it what they call it a lagoon. And I always say to people, we ain't talking about that blue lagoon that Brooke Shields was hanging out in. We talking about a lagoon that's filled with nothing but feces and hog urine, hog feces and urine, and that the animals are kept confined in these tiny houses where you can have up to 5,000 animals in one house, and they don't have the space to move about. They're kept in little cages. Many of them can't even turn around in spaces so small, especially the grown pigs. They can't turn around the space and so forth. The space is so small, they get a lot of broken limbs and stuff, and as a result, and they're on cement flooring from birth to death. And they have flax in the floor inside these houses where the waste, whatever the animals do, fall through the slack in the floor and is going into a piping system underneath the ground that runs from the houses that they're kept in out to the open air lagoons that the hole that they dug in the ground. And so the waste is flushed into this lagoon, and there's no tops on these lagoons, so it's just open in the environment. And when the lagoons begin to fill up, they have to maintain what they call a 250 feet floorboard space to keep, supposedly to keep the lagoons from running over and spilling out onto the land around it. But that don't always work. And so, but to prevent them, to try to prevent it from spilling over, they have irrigation system where they use industrialized irrigators that's connected to those lagoons, and they spray that waste out around the crops in the community, and it's making people sick. It gets in the air, and it stinks real bad. People have a lot of trouble with watery eyes, running noses, headaches, nausea, actually vomiting, high blood pressure, a lot of stress and anger, a lot of upper respiratory problems. We've documented the children living in those areas, if they are within a 5-mile radius of these of this activity, they have been documented having more higher rates of asthma than children living 5 miles outside of that radius, and being on more asthma medication, missing more time out of school. They don't sleep good at night, you know, so they restless, and it affects their school performance. And, you know, because of the disturbances from the big trucks going up and down highways at night, you know, transporting those animals. And they have what they call dead trucks that come around to pick up all the dead animals, which they keep in what they call dead boxes. They used to be out at the edge of the highway, and they could be right near somebody's house, but we made so much fuss about it and made it such a public awareness that they have now began hiding those dead boxes. And so, but the trucks would come around because they would just stack the animals in and they'd be piled up. And sometimes they spill out. And the drivers in the trucks just say, once they spill out, those animals are hard to pick up. once they die because they be disintegrated. And so it's hard to get them. And so that's a problem. That was a problem as well. But anyway, so as a result of dead boxes, you have a lot of buzzards in the community, a lot of pests, and, huge mosquitoes, these big yellow flies and stuff that people said was never there before this activity started taking place. And so just working with that, with the trying to change those conditions, working with communities to fight for change. We've been battling with the state, as I stated already. We've been battling with the state now for nearly 3 decades about changing that waste system to a more technologically friendly system to handle the waste that would eliminate the amount of odor that people have to deal with, and the amount of ground contamination from the waste spilling out on the land and running downhill into streams in the community, which lead straight to the rivers. And so the water keepers and the river keepers in North Carolina have well documented the impact of the pork industry on the rivers and streams in North Carolina. They have all kinds of pictures and videos and everything, and they have an area air force, so they can go up in the air and fly over these areas and document stuff that you may not see if you're on the ground. And then they will give it the information. They try giving it to the state, to the regulatory agency, which is the Department of Environmental Quality, everybody called DEQ, to give them the information to show the violations of these contract growers with this industry who are raising the animals on behalf of Smithfield and the WH group, which comes out of China. They growing the animals for them. And so, they're trying to show the amount of violations taking place, because then the state needs to go in and inspect, and then if they find the problem, issue fines. They have not done a good job of that, because for years our regulatory agency, DEQ, was in the pockets of the pork industry, and everybody in the state knew it. Until Governor Cooper came to town and we got a new administration, only then did that relationship weaken it, and not have so much power over our regulatory agency. But we still got problems that need to be fixed in that arena. And we're still working on it, still working with the Department of Environmental Quality to do a better job at reining in the pork industry, in so that people are not so devastated by them making the amount of money that they make in this state.
They make that amount of money, and I've read in some of the stuff I read about you is there's actually a newer system they can implement, but they keep postponing the requirement to do that.
So. Right. And as a matter of fact, Smithfield paid for the research to be done to identify this new technology. They gave this researcher from North Carolina State $17.2 million to identify some clean technology by the name of Mike Williams. He was able to identify, he found 5 new technologies that could be used that would be better than the lagoon and spray field system. And once he presented it, then the pork industry told our state legislators that it was not economically feasible for them to put that technology on the ground, and the state let them get away with that. But you're making billions of dollars in profit every year, and you can't afford it, and then you want these growers who you already treating like chastised slavery, then you want them to pay for this stuff. You know, they in a catch, they in a fix and a bind themselves, even if they don't recognize it. They are in a bind because they are being so underpaid for the work that they're doing for that billion-dollar industry, and barely able to keep their own land and stuff, and have to do business with them in order to keep their property, because their property is so attached to that business through loans and stuff, that if they don't do what the industry tells them to do, they'll take the animals from them. And if they take the animals, that's total bankrupt for people. And so that's why they, you know, keep doing what they're doing. They're trying to protect their way of life. And through that process, they have managed to pit neighbors against neighbors, because some of those contract growers are neighbors, well, no, not some, all of them are neighbors to somebody that's not working for that industry. And so they are being affected by what these growers are doing. And then the industry told the state that the odor and the waste does not leave the property line of from where it's produced. And, you know, first of all, unless you're just outright stupid, how would you even believe something like that? I mean, air does not stand still. Everybody know water doesn't stand still. So how you going to tell me it don't run off nowhere else, like you controlling it? That's just a lie from the pit of hell. And but they got away with it. They got away with it because they lined everybody's pockets up there in Raleigh. And so they were able to get away with that. But so then we had some researchers from Johns Hopkins University, spearheaded by one of our colleagues that used to be here at the University of North Carolina, a former student of Dr. Steve Wing, who had some researchers come down, and they did what they called a pig two-back study. And so in this pig two-back study, they took swabs, and they swabbed the outside of people's homes, around their windowsills, their air-conditioned units, and the walls of their out, you know, their homes, their outer walls. And then they went inside, and they swabbed the inside of people's homes, swabbing countertops, refrigerator tops, coffee table tops, children's toys, and stuff like that. And they found whole animal waste on the outside of people's homes and on the inside. So we said, so did you say that it don't leave the property line? So then could you help us understand how the hell it got in my house? You know? Not my house, because I don't live in the area, but this is what people are saying. But how did it get in my house? You know, how did it get in my house if it does not leave the property line? I'm not raising these animals. I'm not spraying that waste. You know, and of course the industry was pissed then. And so, and because that was information that was used against them in court as well. And I don't know if y'all heard about the Hogg nuisance lawsuits.
I have heard about it. I heard it got reduced. I was hoping you could talk about that.
Yeah, so we're 500 citizens from Eastern North Carolina. Filed a class action lawsuit against Smithfield and Murphy Brown as the owners of these animals that's creating such a problem for people. And so they filed this class action lawsuit, and the lawyer out of Salisbury, North Carolina, Wallace and Graham is the law firm. The lead attorney is Mona Lisa Wallace. And so they are representing these 500 people. It originally started with this lawyer out of Kansas, and the courts the court said that the out of town lawyers couldn't handle the cases in North Carolina, and so that they had to assign the North Carolina attorney And that's when Mona Lisa and them came in. And anyway, so it finally, after about 4 years or more, it finally got, the cases finally reached federal court and was accepted to be heard. And so they began hearing those cases in April. You know, time going so fast now. It seems like it was April of maybe 2018 and not 2019. I can't really, truly, honestly. And I'm thinking it was 2018 because in 2016 and 2017, there were two bills that came from our state government, one from the House Bill 467, that was designed to prevent citizens from being able to sue over nuisances like they've done in this hog nuisance case against agriculture and forestry industries for any harms done. And then that was in 2016. Then in 2017, they came back. Well, in 2016, with the 467, they were trying to prevent them from suing, and so they wound up writing a bill that stated that the citizens, that you couldn't sue for more than your property value, for anything beyond property value, unlike they can in these current nuisance cases where they've listed out all the harm done, their health problems, their quality of life impacts, the impacts on their air and water, and all the things that's affected. And then in House Bill 467, they took away all those things and that you can only do address your property value loss. And that was it. And then they came back in 2017. 467 wasn't good enough. So they came back in 2017 and passed Senate Bill 711, which said you cannot sue, period. It didn't say for property or anything. So you just can't sue these industries for harm done. And so we see that as a constitutional violation of people's right to redress their government for things, you know, not working like they're supposed to in society. And so as a result, we filed a constitutional challenge to those two bills under the fact, as the result of them taking away our constitutional right to redress our government. And so that's going to be going through the courts sometime soon, probably.
So they did get them passed where they said you guys could not sue, and you have a competing action against that, and it's going through the courts now? But they had actually passed?
Yeah, those bills passed. Those bills passed. They sure did. Yeah. Even though people were there testifying and telling their own stories at the state level, we had citizens from all around the Eastern North Carolina that was being impacted to come. They went to Raleigh, and they were inside those hearings. They testified, they told their stories, they answered questions, and the elected officials sat there, heard all the facts, and still passed those two bills. You know, again, we know this because the pork industry money is long and strong in North Carolina, and everybody know it. So, but, you know, I started this out with, these are some things that people can help with, assist with, you know, by hearing what the issue is, understanding what all the moving parts are, and then, you know, leaning in wherever you can. And one of the ways that things that can normally help in address this whole problem of environmental injustice is affecting policy change. And so maybe your representatives in Western North Carolina may not know about the issue. How do we get them informed and up to speed, and then their constituents push them to support a particular, you know, bill or particular rule or something, and, you know, try to fight for change that way.
One of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, we talked before, and I told you we've started a group, a project with a group that we have. We're, since my husband and I left fracking country, we became very aware of the impact of our buying decisions, like single-use plastic bottles. I mean, we basically had our entire environment destroyed so people could use a plastic bottle once and throw it away. And we were those people. We were thinking if we recycled, it was fine. But then we learned that we started learning and studying, and it's like plastic doesn't get recycled. You know,
right,
the oil is cheaper than plastic. They buy the oil, and it's a sham.
That's right.
We have one bag of trash a year in our home because that's, we feel like we destroyed our own home, and how can we learn from that? And so we started a group called Moving to Conservers. And it's a group of study, conversation, and local action. That's been our tagline for years. And when the Black Lives Matter, when George Floyd got murdered, and we started looking at systemic racism, you know, John and I said, what are we doing now that we're completely unaware of that's hurting other people? And so we focus a lot on food because I feel like if people have clean water, like you started this whole conversation, clean water and food, it brings a calm to a community, but if you think you're going to starve, it's a whole different ballgame. So we are researching our food choices and finding out what's harmful to people. And I get a report from the Sierra Club lobbyist, and he sent, and over the years I've been seeing this hog farm issue, and it came up again recently. And that's how we kind of got started on this. Like, well, what are we doing? Do we know what impacts our buying decisions are having on others? So that's how I got to find you and wanted to talk to you. Like, obviously, we now know that factory farm meats hurt a lot of people.
Definitely. I know we always say in our coalition, which is made up of the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, some of our community partners in the Water Keepers Alliance and the River Keepers, we always say that is not, that's not farming, you know, because that's just operations. Those are operations, that's not farming. When you look at the massive levels of production, you know, it's an operation more so than a farm. We start thinking back and just reminding people of what farming looked like.
Yeah, we actually have interviewed a local hog farmer, and she and her husband are very, very conscientious. You go to their farm, which is right across from a brewery, and you can't smell anything.
Tom Butler?
No, it's Jackie and Jay Eden. In Brevard, so there are ways to do it, and we have an example right here in our community, so that's what we're trying to, by talking to you and helping you educate us on what's going on and ways we can get involved. And what I'm hearing is don't buy factory farm pork or meat, and get your legislature up to speed. And I do believe the more that we can form relationships with each other, you know, it's like it's not – you know, now it's not just a person that's being dumped on. It's Naima working in the community because I've talked to Naima and now I have a relationship with you. And we would love, and I don't know, I mean, maybe you could connect us with the right people or what, but we would love to do a project where we could send them like pieces of material. We do this in our community when topics come up and people can just write their thoughts. Like when we were afraid we were going to lose healthcare and we just had people on the street write their thoughts, and we hung it in the community so people could see. And maybe we can do something where people there who are living with this can share their thoughts with us. Maybe they can answer the question, you know, what do you need from us? And they can send it to us, and we can hang it in the community, and we can start to form these relationships so that we can you know, stay educated, talk to our legislators, do the work that needs to be done, but this can't continue. This is a perfect form example of systemic racism.
Definitely.
It's
got to stop. And that's just one of the issues. And, you know, again, we still got the Gen X problem here. Mm-hmm. We got the coal ash. We have human waste treatment plants presenting problems for people. I always say, you name it. Whatever white people don't want dumped around them, you can find it in eastern North Carolina. I always call it the dumping ground for the state of North Carolina. It's like whatever they don't want, you can definitely find where we are. And landfills, you know, you name it. It's all these various and the problem with that also is that some of the stuff is piled up in the same places. Some communities have some Gen X, they have some coal ash, they have some animal waste, they got a waste treatment plant that spilled over somewhere, you know, and so they're dealing with all of these things. A landfill, and so we call those cumulative impacts that, you know, it's just a bit much for anybody, human, to take in and to try to live through and continue to fight for a good life, a decent life, you know, a life free from being made sick, free from not being able to breathe when you step outside, free from your water being contaminated. So then you're forced to buy water just to have enough water to do what you need to do, enough clean water. And these are already economically stressed communities, so every time you're forced to add something to your budget, it's even more of a strain. And so now you're having to buy water, you're having to go to the laundromat versus using your clothesline. You know, you're having to keep your doors and windows shut, so then you got to find ways to cool your house down. And, you know, these are things that people didn't have to worry about. But now that's all they're having to worry. I mean, they've just been overwhelmed with these kinds of things. And it's like, I can't afford it. But what do I do? I either afford it or just go on and let them finish killing me.
Yeah, do you think if we reached out to the communities and could form relationships and stay educated, and then we could help with the policy stuff, because, you know, we would have a direct relationship with our neighbors that, you know, we don't realize how much we're impacting their lives. Do you think that they would be open to that?
Yeah, I think that would be a big help. You know, again, as I stated when I first came on, is that, you know, a part of the problem is everybody don't understand what the issues are, what the concerns are, what the, you know, the evidence of environmental racism. What's the evidence of it? What is the, you know, what's the drive behind it? What's the driving force? And it's capitalism. And it's institutionalized racism. It's all these things that say, I have the right to do what I want to do, and you get nothing unless I want you to have it.
Yeah, that's a powerful statement. That's a powerful statement.
Yeah, it's just so much stuff. It's so much stuff. Sometimes it's mind-boggling. You know, sometimes I be out going to community meetings, and I get a phone call from another community saying, I heard about y'all's work, and we have an asphalt plant about to be put in our community, and we don't want it, and we don't need it because everybody over here is already sick, and this just going to exacerbate everything. Can y'all help us? And I was like, and I be driving, and I'm thinking, man, this shit don't never stop.
Right.
Excuse my language, but
that's
just what I said, because that's what I felt. right at that moment, you know. And I was like, it's all every day something. And, you know, I mean, calls be coming fast and steady. The wood pellet industry, you know, that's another problem we're having around the state of North Carolina. And so that's something everybody needs to be watching out for. But the wood pellet industry has been on the move in North Carolina, and they've set up, I think, probably about 3 or 4 different of these Enviva plants. The plant is called Enviva, and they have one in Northampton County. They have one in Hamlet, North Carolina, which all the communities have been opposing these plants, but they keep getting the permit they need to operate, which is where we have fought with DEQ.
So can I ask you one other question? I do want to follow up about connecting our communities so that we can maybe do that art project where we can send each other sheets, you know, pieces of sheet, and we can do all that. But I did send you one other question, and I am interested in your response to this. And if you were going to create a new food system, what would it look like? I mean, if you could come in and say, these factory, they're not farms, these factory hell holes, and we need a new food system. Based on everything that you've experienced, what would you design? What would it look like?
Well, basically, it would look more like what it used to look like when the animals were grown on the ground versus inside houses kept in cages. So it would be more sustainable in terms of, you know, animals being animals. Pigs being who they are, being able to live like they live and play around and roll around in the dirt and the mud, dig their snouts in the ground if that's what they want to do. And, you know, like we have sustainable farmers here in the state that's still doing it, you know, growing the old way with the animals on the ground. And, you know, the part of the problem is everybody can't afford to buy those products because there's such a competition from the industrialized animals making the meat so cheap that people are going to go for the cheap stuff rather than going and get the sustainable meat, which is a distinct difference in the taste and the smell. And, you know, but everybody can't afford that meat. But I believe if we were able to go back to a sustainable system that we could drive the prices down to a way that it makes it affordable for everybody.
Yes, and I also believe, and I saw a sign, a billboard, a picture of a billboard from the pork industry, and it said 3 times a day. And, you know, our meat consumption has increased significantly, and it's going back
yes.
to the time when you didn't eat meat 3 times a day every meal, and just realizing that that drives the profit margin for these factory farms to produce that much meat, and just realizing that, you know, it's just not something the world can sustain. Everybody in this world can't eat meat 3 times a day and have a world that we can live in.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, but that's what I would see. And then, you know, we wouldn't have those lagoons and spray fields out there contaminating the air and the land. And everything would eventually probably clean itself, and then you have systems that can be used to clean stuff up. And then eventually, it's probably going to be over a long period of time, people will be able to breathe easier and not be afraid to drink their water. And the thing I always remember is that, you know, I love to travel, and that as I travel around, everywhere you go outside these U.S. borders, people are conservationists. They pay attention to what they're doing, how much water they're using, where their waste goes, you know, what you do about getting rid of the waste, how can you get rid of it in a way that have such a devastating impact on somebody else. And, you know, and I just, it was always amazing to me. I remember I went to Cuba, and then that was really, I was really blown away, because they don't even allow you to flush the waste in any sort of way. You had to bag it.
That's so interesting you mentioned that, because I keep asking myself, why is my waste allowed to impact your life?
Right.
And
yeah.
I ask people that, and the first response I get from that question is, that's a negative question. And I just don't, I'm like,
but it's not a negative question. Yeah. And, you know, you say that, and I often say that to people when I'm talking, doing environmental presentations. I often say in those presentations, you know, environmental injustice is everybody's problem. And it's that way because if you live, if you're breathing, you know, then it's your problem. If you eat food, it's your problem. If you flush in the toilet, it's your problem. If you're drinking water, it's your problem. You know, it's everybody's problem. Because when I flush my toilet, it could have an impact on you up in the mountains.
Yep.
It just depends on what folks that's collecting this stuff decide to do with, like the waste treatment centers. You know, the industry now, they have, they contract out with a company to come around and vacuum out the tanks inside the waste treatment plants where the water goes through and treat itself. And then as the water is treated, whatever doesn't liquefy falls into the bottom of the tank as a solid form. And so they have companies that come in, vacuum out the bottom of those tanks, and they take the stuff that they vacuum out of the waste treatment centers, and they truck it out and give it to farmers as free fertilizer, and they will spray it on the land for them. And the farmers fall for it because it's free fertilizer and it's free manpower. And then that's another one that's pitted the neighbors against one another, because the impacts from that is the same impact that I hear people living with industrialized agriculture having, you know, talk about. They can't breathe, the air is not good, the water has changed, you know, I can't open my doors and windows whenever I get ready, can't hang my clothes on the line because if the odor rises up, you have to redo your laundry because it gets into the clothing, and you can't wear it, and children have worn stuff to school that didn't get rewashed and been teased, talking about they stink, smell like a hog, and stuff like that. And so, you know, you have to redo your laundry, all these things. And I remember going to this lady's house in Virginia when we were addressing the community health effects of sewage sludge, because the waste industry call the stuff biosolids. That's the technical name for the stuff coming from the waste treatment plant. It's biosolids. But the street language is sewage sludge. And so we was doing a study looking at the impacts, the health impacts of people having to live near this stuff. And some of the stories we heard sound just like the stories we heard with people living around these industrialized agriculture. And I remember going to one lady's house, and she had duct taped up every window in her house and everywhere where a crack might be or where air could come into the house. She had duct taped everything. We was like, why you do that? Why is all this duct tape? She said, because I'm trying to keep the odor from getting in my house. And that was just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I don't care what nobody say. This is criminal behavior these people doing. Some of these folks need to be in jail. They need to be in jail.
Well, Naima, I think it's, like you said, it's education, and we want to do that here, and we would appreciate any help that you could give us, anybody you could connect us to, and we'll start educating. And if we could connect with community members there, and we'll just get to know each other, and then it's not, you know, oh, it's just somebody in Eastern North Carolina that's getting pig spray. It's, well, no, it's Naima. You're not doing that to her. I'm crazy.
And now we are getting ready to hold our annual Environmental Justice Summit. Normally we do it face to face, but because of COVID, it's going to be a virtual summit this year, and it's going to happen throughout the month of October, where we'll have like an hour and a half long session.
So you're saying October you have you're going to have a virtual summit?
Yeah, we're going to have a virtual summit and. I was telling you because I was thinking that could be something as a participant in the summit. If you want to participate, you could raise that idea at the summit with folks.
I would love to participate. Count me in. Whatever I can do. Yes.
Okay. So. Our registration would be going up probably within another week. We have registration up on our website. And so you can go to the website to register for it.
And then I can join our organization, right? Moving to Conservers is the name of our organization, and we can join for $100.
Yeah. So just, you know, if you want to attend the summit and as many people as you want to inform or ask to be a part of it, all that do is register and, you know, go to our website, pull up the registration and follow the instructions.
Okay. Well, we will do
okay.
that. We will join, and thank you so much, Naima. I feel like crying, honestly.
Don't cry. I know the feeling. Yeah, I know the feeling because I can tell you that I have had days where that's what I did. You know, I had to cry because I couldn't do anything else. But it's so heartbreaking. But then when you go to the communities, you know, as an organizer, I'm out in the field, so I'm out there. I'm visiting all of these communities. And to be able to go and see and hear from people, that is really heartbreaking, you know, and you see what people are going through, and they so generous with their time and their whatever they have. You know, they like to feed you. They like to try to take care of you. They worry about you being safe when you leave them and stuff, you know.
Right.
And because I travel, like, I go to a meeting, I don't care what time it is, when it's over, I'm going home. And they'd be like, Naima, you going home tonight? I was like, yes, I sure am. Well, you sure you want to do that? Yeah, I don't mean no harm. And I ain't trying to offend nobody, but Naima likes to go home and get in her own bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just how And so I'm not trying to offend anybody, but it's nothing like your own bed. And so they was like, okay. And I don't care how far away I am, because I know one time I was down in Supply, North Carolina. That's down, you're almost at Myrtle Beach when you get to this community that I was in called the Royal Oak community. And that was like about at least a four-hour drive, not a second less. And the meeting started at 7 o'clock in the evening. I think it ended maybe about 9:30. Me and two of my colleagues that were there, Peter Gilbert from the UNC Civil Rights Law Center, Ann Joyner from the Cedar Grove Institute, we had the nerve to stop and eat at this Chinese restaurant after we got done with the meeting instead of trying to get our butts on because they had to go to Chapel Hill and I was coming to Rock Him Out. So they had 2 hours longer than me to get on.
Wow.
And but we did it. We left, and all the people at the meeting was like, Naima, you going home tonight? You don't have to do that. You can stay with me out. I'll put you up at my house. Because I got tickled, because even some of the men said, you don't have to do it. You can come to my house. I'm thinking to myself, you ain't asked your wife. You ain't finna get me killed. So, and I was laughing at them when I left. I was so tickled at the men in there that said that, because I was like, now, I know you were probably married, and you ain't said nothing. You ain't asked your wife nothing. You just going to take a woman home in the middle of the night. I don't. It won't be me. I won't be the one. So, but just how generous they are, you know, and stuff. And so I love the work that I do. I love working with the community. I love meeting all the different people. And I just thoroughly enjoy seeing people change their mind, going from feeling like they helpless and can't do nothing to standing up and fighting back. It's nothing like it.
That's for sure. I've certainly been involved in that kind of work as well. And it is. I saw it when I was on city council. We helped get a mayor out of office that needed to go. And I watched 9 citizens show up to that city council and change our city. And it was just astounding to be a part of that. And, people, I tell people, I saw 9 people change a community of 35,000, 40,000 people. And you can
do it.
You just don't realize how powerful you are. And
That's right. Now, do you remember, or you ever heard of Frank Rizzo from Philadelphia, the mayor? He was this racist mayor in Philadelphia that wanted to change Philadelphia into a police state, and he told the police that black people were nothing but animals and shoot to kill. I was living in Philadelphia during this time, so this is not hearsay. I was there. I heard him. And anyway, he wanted to change the charter. He had already been in office 2 terms, so he wanted to change the charter in order to run a 3rd term. And we was like, oh, hell no, not on our watch, you won't. And so we beat the streets from sun up to almost sun up again, going to every possible house that we could get to in the city, encouraging people to vote against that charter, explaining to them why they need to vote against it, and what would happen if we didn't win. And we turned out the vote, you hear me? And we won, and we were celebrating in the streets on Broad Street. And Broad Street in Philadelphia is a street that runs all the way through the city from one end of the city to the other end, to the furthest end south to the furthest end north. It's a straight shot down Broad Street. And we were out there celebrating, and the police came up, and we was like, you know what? Your boy just lost, so you better get out of our face. And they left us alone, too.
That's awesome.
They left us alone. And other time, they'd have jumped out and start billy clubbing folks. But they knew they didn't want the war they was about to get if they had to mess with somebody.
Wow,
and I'll never forget being a part of that. It was so much. I enjoyed that, too, getting up early in the morning, going out door to door, you know, explaining to people, asking them to make sure they get out to vote, and what can we do to help you get out if it's a problem for you. And,
right.
You know, and it was, I'm telling you, we did everything we could, and we didn't have no holds barred on what we would do to help people get out to vote.
Our theme song is Gutalele's Happy Place by Stephen Cartenberg. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information, visit movingthroughconservers.com.